Okay, just think about this. You're sitting overlooking a lake in the USA. You're like, I have a bike. I have legs. I think I'm going to run across and cycle across the entire USA. That's literally what put this idea into today's guest's head, which is absolutely amazing. I've mentioned on the podcast in the past how I use people's achievements and people who inspire me to basically get my own goals hit, or particularly to get my training in on days I'm not feeling particularly motivated. So, for example, when I was training for Marathon de Sable last year, the 6 back-to-back marathons in the Sahara Desert, my friend Damien Brown, who has been on the podcast twice, had just rode solo across the Atlantic. And I was thinking on days when I wasn't feeling very motivated or I wasn't feeling very energetic and I didn't want to get my runs in, I'm like, well, fucking Damien is rowing across the Atlantic. I was like, I can run 20 kilometers today. And I did something very, very similar when I ran the Arctic in February of this year. So when I ran 230 kilometers to the Arctic, my friend, fucking in-betweeners. I said my friend twice. I have lots of friends. Anyways, my friend Ross Edgley, my mate, my chum Ross Edgley, who's also been on the podcast twice, was swimming around the UK. So he set like every world record you can swimming around the UK. And when I was preparing for the Arctic, when I was really struggling with either the cold conditioning or again physically getting my training in, I would think to myself, man, Ross is swimming around the UK. I can get in this ice bath and I can stay there longer than I normally do, or I can get out and I can get my training runs in. Today's guest gives me that very similar feeling, and somebody that I'll be using myself going forward for future events. And that man is Shane Finn, who over the space of 36 days ran and cycled across the USA. So for 4 days in a row, he would cycle, then he would run for 2 days, and he repeated that 6 times for a total of 36 days, starting at the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco on the West Coast and ending on the Brooklyn Bridge in New York on the East Coast. In today's episode, this is very much a just sit back and enjoy episode. We talked about everything that he did in the lead up to the event. So a year and a half worth of training and recovery and putting his life on lockdown for the 7 months prior. And then everything during the event. So the actual 36 days of rotating between the bike and running, the distance of over 4,000 kilometers. If I think it's 4,000 kilometers, I actually need to double check that. I think it was 4,000 kilometers, which is just ludicrous. It's a fucking ludicrous distance over the space of 36 days. So how he ate, how he recovered, the high points, the low points. So without further ado, just sit back and enjoy today's episode with Shane Finn, who ran and cycled across the entire USA. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I am delighted to be joined today with my guest, Shane Finn. Shane is an online coach, ultra endurance athlete, and social media influencer. You may recognize his voice from episode 120 titled Shane Finn on 24 Marathons in 24 Days that we recorded way back in November 2017. In today's episode, we're going to talk about Shane's most recent adventure, which had him run and cycle across the USA. Shane, welcome back to the podcast.
What's up, Brian? I'm still alive, man. How are you getting on?
Just about, I'd say. Shane, we talked about your backstory in episode 120, which I'll link to in the show notes, so we're not going to go into that. Yeah. So let's just jump straight into the US challenge. Tell us about it and what it entailed.
Yeah, so again, obviously, you know, we spoke about the 24 marathons, 24 days. I think you've had a lot of guests on, Brian, that have done some kind of mad things, you know, and it's a common trait where you do something like this. Maybe you can resonate it with yourself as well. And some of the listeners, and there's no point in trying to cover it up. You do feel a bit empty. Like there's something, you know, you've devoted so much time to training, preparing physically, mentally, and then it's just gone, you know, and you're back to your normal life. So that did happen post 24 marathons, 24 days. And before we got on this podcast, I was actually checking back on my own notes and stuff like that. And I actually hadn't come up with the idea of doing what I just did when we spoke. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic to the conversation. But shortly after the 24 marathons finished, you know, it was great. We raised a ton of money. The charity were delighted. And I do a small bit of part-time teaching for a university in Connecticut, which is about 90 minutes north of Manhattan. And it's a fantastic university. I was over there for a couple of days. And I got a phone call from one of the people in the office of the charity to say, look, we got some bad news. The funding's been cut by 50 grand for next year. So naturally, you know, after raising 142 grand by running around every fucking back road in Ireland for 24 days, it annoyed me a small bit, you know, because I have quite a close family connection to the charity as well. And I was like, you know what, I think this is a little bit of a sign or a signal to maybe do something again. Maybe it was the trigger I needed, to be honest. You know, so I took it that way anyways. And I was like, it could be a sign to maybe stop doing it, but it could be a sign to maybe keep doing things too. So I was in America at the time. I went for a walk down on Fairfield Beach. It's a tiny little town. And I was looking out onto the Atlantic Ocean. I was like, that's it. Like, that's it. You're in America. You have to cross America. So I was delighted with myself. But I quickly realized that America is a big, it's a big country.
I'm going to pause for a second. I'm like, no, you know, Shane, nobody else has that thought when they're looking across the lake. I'm going to run across America.
It's big. Like, I mean, I've driven from Dingle to Dublin quite a lot. And I like that drive, like, does my head in. Like, that doesn't even move you on the dot in the Google Maps in America, you know. So I knew pretty quickly that I couldn't run the whole thing. I probably could, you know, it'd be a phenomenal adventure, but it would take nearly, I think I did the math, I think it was going to take me over 100 days. And I was like, I can't get crew to commit for that amount of time. It'd be incredibly selfish, you know, and B, I said, it's just too long, you know, it's just too drawn out. Back in 2014, I ran from Dublin to Dingle, and that took me 12 days. And then I did the 24 marathons in 24 days. I was like, I'm a bit of a weirdo when it comes to these things. And I was like, well, it has to be 36, you know, that's the way the numbers are kind of going. So I, quickly got to work, planning out like how we're going to structure this, et cetera, et cetera. And I just had this spring in my head for some reason. I don't know why. It was like, it gave me a hold of nearly the majority of 2018 and in 2019 to prepare. You know, I was giving myself, I did everything. I gave myself time to get injured, time to recover. I did the whole thing and off we set. So that the plan was early on, the plan was to bike for 3 days and run for 3 days. That's 6 days and I do that six times. But it then turned to biking for 4 days and running for two. So on the bike, I'd do anywhere from, I think the minimum I did one day was 180K, and then the maximum I did one day was like 309. So it's a long old day in the saddle, like 13, 14 hour days and biking. And then the runs were anywhere from kind of marathon distance upwards. So I think 57, 58K was my longest run. And you're just doing it constantly day after day. So it turned out to be 4 days on the bike, 2 days running, 4 days on the bike, 2 days running. And then I repeated that 6 day cycle six times to get me from the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco to the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. And it's definitely a lot bigger than Ireland, but it was a hell of an experience. And I actually enjoyed it. People are like, would you do something like that again? And I'm going to be completely honest, I probably would, because it's just such a phenomenal, like, physical, mental, emotional experience that it's like, once you do something like this, it's very hard to just put it to bed and never do something like that again. So, look, I really enjoyed it. I there was a lot more obstacles in the way, obviously, than previous things I'm sure we'll chat about. But no, phenomenal experience. Great country. I don't care. People can say what they want about America, but we got nothing but friendliness and offers of help and support, and people were so kind to us. And we had a great time. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, testament to you, and I'm dying to dive into it. And as you said, the American people, I used to live in California and absolutely loved it. I think they're amazing people and an amazing country. I'm going to jump around, Shane. I'm going to jump a little bit before, a little bit during, a little bit after. So I'm just kind of going to kind of memento style this. Sure. Your training in the lead up to it, What did you do to physically prepare your body in the lead up to such, you know, that amount of stress and endurance that your body was going to be able to need to be able to withstand? What did your training protocol look like? I know it started, you know, 2018 in the lead up to 2019. Talk me through kind of not even a sample week, but what the macro training program looked like.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I completely changed the way I trained for the 24 marathons to the way I trained for America. And, you know, I suppose in our stuff, Brian, we talk a lot about periodization, and I followed very much so a non-linear periodized kind of system going into America. And I'll tell you why, because I noticed that if I had some kind of adaptability going into my, I trained in 10-day blocks, not week blocks, because I found that 10-day blocks, it gave me a bit of adaptability, for example. So, you know, everybody has this thing in their head that they have to do their long run on a Saturday. But if I'm tired on a Saturday morning, I get up at 6 o'clock to do a long run, and I'm really tired, I'm sore, and my quads are sore, and I'm aching, and I'm hungry. You know, the you know, you could go run, but the probably the best thing to do is probably maybe push it back a day and take an easy day and go for a swim or do a gym session or something like that. So I took a very adaptable, open, kind of non-linear approach to it. I tried to get as much volume as I could in, without, obviously you're obviously you want to overload your system and have that progressive overload, but you also want to not cross that red line very often. So, you know, you stress yourself, you allow yourself to adapt. I did a ton of cycling. I did a lot of cycling going into it because I knew that I could take a lot of biking and it didn't take a massive amount out of me. Maybe that's from like the lot of running in the past. Obviously, I would have come from a running background and running was my thing in the way I started. So I was like, this is a good thing because, you know, my biking would not be as strong as my running. So now it's probably nearly even flipped. I'm probably stronger after America now that I'm on the bike than I am running. But I was very, very conscious of not getting injured. And I know that's it's a cliche thing to say, but I mean, if I knew myself, if I got to the start line in San Francisco injury free and fresh, I could give this thing a serious crack. However, I knew if I went in there with any kind of a niggle or any kind of an ache or a pain or any even phantom pain or something like that, you know, I knew that these kind of things will make those little injuries pop back up. And if you have any kind of symmetrical or kinetic chain weakness going into something like this, it'll find it very, very quickly. And so my main thing was to be very, very fit physically and mentally, and to be injury free. That was my main thing. So I took days off if I wanted to take them off. You know, I would, you know, I might plan to run 20 miles in the morning and do 10 miles in the evening or go out on the bike in the evening. And I was like, if I woke up, I was like, I'm really sore. I'd just do 10 miles rather than 20 in the morning, and then I'd go out on the bike that evening, you know. So it was to constantly keep topping up the glass of water basically without leaving it overflow.
And what did your recovery protocol look like? Because to get to the start line even injury free or more or less injury free, what was your kind of protocol around recovery?
Yeah, so I took, again, my recovery didn't really change, to be honest. So I'm an eater. I like a lot of food. I eat a lot of food. So obviously nutrition was a big part of my recovery. So little things as well, like sleep and stuff like that. I basically, to be honest right now, I think a lot of people who might know me kind of know this. I shut my life down basically for 6 months. I had a glass of wine at my Christmas dinner last year, and that was it. I literally did not let anything into my mouth that shouldn't have been in my mouth for like 6 months. I was very, 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 very like strict to what I was doing, sleeping as much as I could. For me, again, I know it's a cliched, simple thing to say. I slept more. I ate a lot of food, really good food. I took days off when I needed to. I cross-trained a lot. When you get to a kind of a certain point and you're doing something, you can check your resting heart rate. You can use HRV. You can do all these kind of fancy things, but you know yourself. Like, you should know yourself before any app or any device, how you feel and how you're recovering. So if an app tells you that you should go and train, but you're really tired, like, you don't go and train. You should just listen to your body, you know. So that's what I did. And I knew myself the days I could push. I knew the days myself I had to take it back. You know, simple things. I was kept on top of the foam rolling. I did a ton of strength training going into it. Obviously, I love strength training. It's a big part of what I do. So I did a lot of strength training, a lot of, you know, hamstring glute work, things like that. A ton of deadlifting and stuff like that from long, long hours on the bike. A lot of core work, a lot of shoulder mobility stuff. And I just kept myself moving as best I could.
What was your sleep like during the training? The reason I asked that is because when my training volume goes up, and it's nowhere near your level, but when my training volume goes up, the first thing that gets affected is my sleep. What was your sleep like during? How many hours a night were you getting? Were you feeling rested after the majority of night sleep in those 10 block periods? How did you feel during that?
During training, I felt great. So I slept really well. I always sleep pretty well, to be honest. I have a very good sleep routine. So sleep is very rarely an issue for me. Actually, the more my volume goes up, the more I sleep, the deeper I sleep as well. Now, again, I hope I'm not jumping the gun here, Brian, but when I got to America, when I started the event, my sleep was atrocious. I couldn't sleep. It was hot. It was cold. I was sleeping in the back of a camper van, different bed, all this kind of stuff, you know. So that was a challenge in itself. But beforehand, it was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I didn't really have much problem beforehand, to be honest.
How many hours a night were you getting beforehand? Just for context, I'm just curious because mine goes up by an hour or two. But I'm curious, what were you like? So
in that kind of period where I shut my life down for 6 months, I was minimum like 8 hours a night. Like I would get up maybe at like seven, that kind of time, be in bed usually for 11-ish that time. Now I go to bed earlier and get up earlier, but usually around 11 and get up at around 7 again, you know. Yeah.
Okay, let's bring it, because you mentioned the event there, and you kind of gave a taster there, the back of a camper van. I'm like, right, let's dive into this. Talk us through the start of the event. So what did that, we know what it looked like in terms of 4 days on the bike, 2 days running, and you went from west to east. So talk us through the first few days. How was your body feeling? And then factoring in the sleep, and then we're going to kind of dive into the nutrition side of it. So what was the first 5-7 days like, you know, or after even the first cycle of 4 days on, 2 days run, repeat?
Yeah, it's I have a couple of very funny stories for here, but I'll tell the serious stuff first. So basically, before I got started, I was in a really good place. I was in great shape. I actually flew to Boulder in Colorado about a month early, just to do some stuff there. So at Boulder, you had about somewhere between 5, and then on days on the biking, you'd be at like 7,000 feet. So it was great. It was great preparation. It was good to get a kind of stimulus of altitude before I headed off. And then I went from there to San Francisco, and I was in San Francisco for about 3 weeks beforehand, just getting ready to sleep and eating, training, et cetera, and then off we went. And it was, you know, the first couple of days we're still kind of working through cities and stuff like that. The first day we got out towards kind of, you know, we're trying to get out through San Rafael and all this kind of stuff, and there was a shooting, and then we were detoured, and all this kind of mad stuff was happening on the first day. So basically day one, the plan was to do about 280K. I think we got to like I got to 255, and it was just like pitch dark, like 9 o'clock at night. I remember stopping beside this little petrol station beside a river and just being like, I am in for a big, big challenge. I knew myself on that first day. Now, I knew we were being stopped by traffic and cops and red lights and all this kind of stuff, and taking detours around shootings and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, you're not in Dingle anymore, lad. I was like, you're in it now. This is it, you know. And I knew myself. You know, and then we fast forward to day two, we started climbing up. If anybody again knows the geography of kind of California, Nevada, so you have Vegas and you have Lake Tahoe. We kind of went in between the two of them. And we started climbing the Sierra Nevadas on day two. And day two, it was the most I've ever climbed ever on the bike in one go. At one point, I climbed for just under 3 hours nonstop climbing uphill. So that was pretty rough. We lost more distance that day. And then basically, by kind of day 15, I was 300K behind, which was definitely not on the plan. So I knew at the back end, I was going to have to literally pull something out of the bag, or I was going to have to very, very quickly start biking and walking and running through the night and stuff. And I tried everything not to let that happen. There were a couple of nights in Nevada when the kind of terrain flattened out a little bit that I would literally bike up until 10 o'clock at night and just get the crew to follow me in their flat, straight roads in the desert, which wasn't too bad. But the first couple of days were rough. I mean, you know, you can train as much as you want for this kind of stuff. You can try simulated in training, you know, you can do whatever you want at home around here and stuff like that. But when you're there cycling through a desert in the middle of the night, like going up to 10 o'clock, and you know that you have to stop, eat, have a shower and start again the next morning at 6 a.m., it's mentally, it's tough. And then you still know that I have over a month of this left. So that's the challenge. And I suppose that's part of what I actually enjoyed about it. And like I always say, even that when I go back to the 24 and 24, I feel like I'd physically adapted by day 19. So day 19, I woke up, I was like, yep, this is it. I'm not any better. I'm not any worse. This is it. This is now, my body has now taken this as its new normal. I didn't feel that once in America for some reason, but it was kind of, I think I was into the 20s again over in America before I started to get into some kind of a proper sleep routine. And to be honest, looking back, that's the one thing that kind of rattled me a little bit was the sleep. You know, you're in a tight spot, like one of those we had with the camper van was fantastic. Like, it was really cool, like the size expanded and it was really cool, but when you're sleeping in it with like four other people and there's another one right beside you, it's difficult. It's one of the things, and it was one of the things I wasn't really ready for, but it was different. It was definitely an interesting dynamic to the whole trip.
Yeah, I can imagine. And was it a 6 a.m. start time every day? Was that the kind of goal each day, to set out at the same time and then cycle a certain distance, run a certain distance?
It was a 6 a.m. wake up usually. Usually 6 a.m. wake up. Now, again, it would, you know, I'd be up for maybe 10 past, quarter past. So again, I know we'll get into nutrition stuff. Days I was running, I would just maybe get up at 6:30 because I wouldn't eat. But days I was biking, I'd get up a bit earlier and get some food in because, you know, you're seated on the bike and you can get more nutrition in. My stomach can take more. When I was running, I couldn't really, you know, I still can't. I never could, and I never can, I don't think, eat a massive meal and then go running. So I used to start a lot of my longer runs fasted and just have my coffee or whatever. You know, so it was a 6 a.m. wake up usually. And then there were days, you know, we were playing catch up in the middle, especially in Kansas, where I started to actually bike really fast. There was a couple of days I was holding like 33, 34K an hour for like 12 hours. So the couple of those days we got up at 5:30, quarter past 5 even, and just tried to knock out an extra hour in the day just to try chip away at that extra, that deficit, you know, that we had left. And we didn't get back on track until day 35 when I got to Connecticut. So the second last day is when we technically got back on track. So there were a lot of late nights, a lot of early mornings, but it was definitely interesting.
When you were running then, were you running for distance or running for a certain amount of time where you try and cover a specific, you know, 40 kilometers, marathon distance, etc.? Or was it, I'm going to do 5 hours, 6 hours? What was your running protocol?
It was a bit of both, to be honest, Brian. So, I mean, I was, you know, I had distances I tried to hit every day. I mean, Ali, my physio, was like a... She was like my right-hand man, my right-hand person, but she was fantastic. Like she usually, you know, in the morning I'd be getting ready and she'd be like, look, okay, can you get a marathon in before lunch? And I'm like, I think I can, you know. And, you know, you hit it off, you start running, and then, it, you know, you might be going faster than you thought, you might be going a bit slower than you thought, and, you know, then I might stop and get a small bit of food and then finish it out. Now, there was a point where I picked up an Achilles injury. I picked up an Achilles injury on day 9. I climbed for like three days going up the Sierra Nevadas, and it actually happened on the bike, which surprised me. And that obviously, I'm not gonna say it slowed me down, but it held me back slightly because I couldn't run hard. I mean, I love running, I could run for hours, but this thing was pretty sore. It was quite enlarged, it was swollen, it was gone a bit black and blue. So that slowed me a small bit. So, you know, we'd have to lock my foot basically into the bike. My right leg was locked onto the bike, and it was locked in position, so I couldn't really bend my right ankle up and down. So you couldn't dorsiflex or you know, you couldn't do anything with my foot because it was locked in this position. We couldn't do that when I was running because it actually made it worse. So I had to be very careful my running. And then I would, the days where my Achilles was quite sore running, I would have to run a little bit slower, you know, and even implement a little bit of walking on the steeper hills just to mind it. So it was a bit of both, really, to be honest, Brian, with regards to the running. It was trying to hit distances, but it was also trying to not burn the candle from both ends, you know, and try to hit a certain time or a certain pace. I always tried to stay within myself in the running because physically, physiologically even, sorry, like the running would take a little bit more out of you. And I noticed when I got to altitude, like really high altitude when I was running, I used to wake up in the morning and like my ribs would be killing me. I don't know what it was. Obviously, it was a lack of oxygen and maybe the impact from the ground or whatever. And I'd started to lose a little bit of weight this time as well. So it's literally my sides, like not my abdomen, but my sides, like underneath my lungs almost, was just really sore and to breathe and stuff. It's like you did a really tough, like you did, like, I felt like I did a 1 hour like side plank both sides before I went to bed. That's kind of what it felt like. And, you know, so I had things like this popping up. So again, similar to the 24 marathons, 24 days, it would take me an hour, 2 hours, even 3 hours some days to kind of warm up almost and get moving. And then sure, the day's nearly over and you're like, God, I can nearly do another hour. I can nearly do another hour and a half, which sometimes I did, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing how your body responds. What about your diet then? Like, I'm curious, how do you fuel and refuel for that amount of volume? Like, where, take us through, like, was it a typical eating day all the way through, or did you switch it up and vary it as it went on? What did your kind of like eating and diet look like during the, you know, the entire journey?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'll just give a little bit of context as well. I think, look, it's a fairly hot topic at the moment. Endurance and nutrition in general, I think, is becoming a bit popular at the moment, which is kind of cool. It's good to have discussions about it. So we'll just rewind back really quickly. 24 marathons, 24 days, I was a typical carb guy. You know, pizzas, pastas, potatoes. Still am, but now I'm a little bit more educated on myself and in the science of nutrition for endurance. I think what I changed after the 24 and 24 was I wrote down for a week, literally, all my food. And I had done it before, obviously, here and there, but I wrote down a week of my food about 3 months after the 24 marathons. And I was like, that's a lot of food, man. That had a lot of carbohydrate, a lot of sugar, you know. And it wasn't even good quality carbs either. I was just eating bread just to, because I was an endurance athlete, you know what I mean? And I know bread's not bad and stuff like that, but so when you break down the macro profile of what I was eating, carbs were like 75% of my diet. And I was like, all right, this is not good. It's not sustainable long term. It's not good. I need to have a look at this. So then I met a guy called Barry Murray, who is now obviously a really good friend of mine. He is an endurance nutritionist. He's worked with a lot of kind of top, you know, Tour de France teams. The guy's a bit of a freak himself. Like, he does these 24-hour ultras and wins them by like hours with like a bit of cheese in his back pocket and a bit of chocolate. Like, he walks a walk as well, you know. So I reached out to Barry. I said, look, I'd love to meet you. And he goes, I'm actually moving to Dingle. I was like, that's really random, but I said, this is great. So we started doing a bit of work, and then I started to do a little bit of the kind of fat adaptation stuff. Now, I think it's important to note that a lot of people would say, oh, you were keto. I was like, no, I definitely was not keto. However, I did do a lot of fasted training to help my body burn fat as a fuel source a little bit more efficiently. I've never been keto. I never will be keto. I can't be keto because, again, I think if you're at home, if you're an Irish lad and your mammy cooks food for you, it's literally impossible to be keto. So I think,
kicked out of the family, you know, if you're not eating the potatoes.
Like, why aren't you eating your spuds? Like, what's wrong with you? So what I started doing really basically was I started carb backloading. So anytime I would go for a long ride, a long run, I'd eat my carbohydrates afterwards. A lot of endurance athletes would eat their carbohydrates beforehand. And for me, you know, look, again, it's not very nice, not very cool to talk about. You'd be jumping the ditch because you wouldn't be able to control yourself. Like, you'd be taking craps every 2 seconds, you know what I mean? So I was like, look, I'm gonna be crossing the whole continent of America. I can't really have that happening, you know? So I was like, I need to find a way, a more efficient way of fueling myself. So I was like, I started doing this. So I started doing some fasted training. I literally started running for 30 minutes in the morning, like on empty, which I'd never really done before. And I got from 30 minutes to over 5 hours on empty. So that took me a year and a half to do. So I was there getting ready for American Ultra, and I was running up to 5 hours in the mornings or biking for 5 or 6 hours with just 2 or 3 bottles of water. And I started to feel really good. I started to get quite lean. I started to have a lot more energy. Now, the thing is, I was still consuming carbohydrate. I was consuming carbohydrate after I trained. So again, a lot of days I would train, I'd train twice in a day. So people ask, oh, if you're training twice in a day, you're still getting a lot of carbs. And I said, no, I have my carbohydrates after the most intense session. So if I do a 5 hour run in a gym session, I'm going to consume my carbs after the 5 hour run because that takes a little bit more out of me. So I just became a little bit more educated on the timing of my carbohydrate and what worked for me. You know, so I kind of moved away from gels and shakes and stuff like that. I mean, I would supplement with protein when I kind of felt like I needed to. I mean, a ton of meat, ton of fish, stuff like that. But if I felt like I wasn't getting enough protein in, I'd take a little bit more protein. And I kind of took that whole approach with me to America. Now, I will say, you know, people can say what they want about American nutrition, the way Americans eat and stuff. I had no real problems, to be honest, when I got to Colorado and I got to California. The only things we kind of issues we faced really were on the road, and we got to kind of the Midwest and the kind of, well, middle of nowhere really, with kind of finding fresh food and fresh meat and stuff like that. So a typical day in America would be, like I said, on the bike, I would be maybe 4 or 5 eggs in the morning with bacon, avocado and a bit of sourdough toast. And then lunch might be, it could be something, if it's cold, I'd have something like a soup or a broth or something like that, with maybe more, another kind of an omelet or something like that. And then the dinner would be maybe a burger or two, or like a steak or kind of spaghetti bolognese or something like that. Something kind of wholesome, you know, after a day on the long day out on the road. I had my own little kind of, you know, I have this, obviously I'm burning about 8,000 calories a day. So I had ways of kind of getting extra calories in, which, you know, I would do through kind of smoothies or stuff like that. I would do anything kind of just get extra calories in. We found a ton of Kerrygold butter going across America, which is also fantastic for getting calories in. You know, I was just grazing throughout the day as well. I found that to be kind of important. But again, you know, I wasn't smashing gels or I wasn't smashing tons of sugar into me, which I think is an interesting way to go about it. And I suppose, like, I'd never be very, very pushy on anybody with regards to their nutrition. I just try, you know, everybody's different. I mean, I could be here again, Brian, in another 2 years, haven't done something else, and be like, oh yeah, what I said 2 years ago, I don't really do that anymore. It doesn't work for me, so I'm trying this now. So I just think it's important to find out kind of what works for you, you know, and take it from there. But it was, I kept it simple. I mean, you know, I tried my best to simplify the complexities, and that's one of the best quotes I've heard probably in the last 5 years, is to simplify the complexities. And that comes from that guy, Barry. Like, he's a very, very educated man when it comes to endurance nutrition. And he was like, look, simplify the complexities. People make this stuff so complex that they just work it up in their head. But he said, the simpler you can make it, the better. So I took that approach as well. And this is not a joke. In America, they have way better Oreos, like way better,
It's like the Guinness equivalent here when they come here. It's like, no, we go over there. It's like they're Oreos, man.
Oreos, they have double stuff Oreos. So obviously they have a double serving of the white stuff in the middle. And man, they are phenomenal. Like 4 or 5 of them at night after with a cup of tea. Absolutely savage. So they were the kind of things like that. A couple of bits like that I'd have obviously as treats and stuff. You know, there were points as well where I really craved salt, and I found I craved salt obviously quite a lot through the whole thing. So I'd obviously, some days I'd add in a little bit of a snack with like kind of like salty, almost like we have Walkers here. They're like their own brand Walkers. Lay's is what they're called in America. So I'd end some salty chips and stuff like that as well the odd time. And there was one day, all right, where there was a, you know, we had no phone coverage for probably a quarter of the whole trip, and we couldn't find the campsite, we couldn't find where we were staying, and I was starving. I had been out all day, and we just stopped outside of McDonald's in traffic, and we didn't know how far away the campsite was. Like, we didn't know when I was going to get to eat. We had no food in the van. And the three of us, myself, my dad and Ali, were just looking out the window at the McDonald's. And I just said, fuck it, turn in there. And we went in. I got like 2 Big Macs, chicken nuggets, 2 servings of extra large fries, a big thing of Fanta. And that was the only time I actually had a Mackey D's in the whole trip. But I got up the next morning and I had this massive tailwind, and I was going really well on the bike. And my dad was like, it's fucking McDonald's. He has to get him more McDonald's. I was like, no, Dad, I think it's the probably the 50-mile-an-hour tailwinds in my back. But it was still pretty good, you know. Like, even just for my brain, it was very satiating, that McDonald's. I'll never forget it.
That's so funny. I'm actually going to jump between both of these questions. There was obviously a low point and obviously a high point. Like, anytime you do anything along these lines, I know there's countless low points and countless high points, but does a particular high point or a particular low point jump out? Was there a moment where you're like, and because sometimes I know people think that the high point is the end. In a lot of cases, it isn't. And some people think the low point is like when you get an injury. In a lot of cases, it isn't. What did that look like for you? What was the highest point and the lowest point that you felt physically, mentally, emotionally during the entire journey?
Yeah, there's two that stick out to me. I mean, they're, like you said, there's numerous. And again, we talk about, you know, I know you talk about it quite a lot on your channels, on your podcasts and stuff. And it's something I'm exploring myself. A lot of it's kind of self-talk and negative self-talk and positive self-talk and stuff like that. But, you know, when people meet me, they're like, you know, how'd you do it? And how'd you stay so positive? I mean, like, there was probably like 11 times a day over the 36 days where I didn't want to do it and I wanted to quit, you know, but it's and I just wanted to go to the nearest airport and come back home. But it's, I think, with regards when those little things pop up, I think it's really important to kind of take your couple minutes and just, you know, deal with it and put it aside and then come up with a couple of things that you're grateful for. That's one little technique I found. But with regards high points and low points, I think the high point for me was about 2 days before I started. There was a young lad that I met he was at one of the resource centers in Dublin, and his name is Brian. Lovely young lad. And, you know, Brian would have, I suppose, benefited from fundraisers and stuff we did in the past with regards to summer camps and respite and stuff like that. And Brian was brought to hospital with quite serious issues about 3 or 4 days before I started. And I remember it just occupied a lot of space in my mind because I knew him personally. You know, I always chatting to him and stuff and things like that. And, you know, I think I remember saying to somebody, everyone's like, oh, are you ready and stuff like that? Like, what do you do? How are you feeling and stuff? I was just like, I said, poor Brian's in hospital. Like, it doesn't matter how I feel before starting this. Like, that young lad's fighting for his life above in Dublin Hospital. And this was like 2 or 3 days before I started. And I remember about, I think it was day 11. Again, I was climbing and climbing and climbing. We'd no phone coverage. I didn't know what was going on in the outside world, blah, blah, blah. Got to the top of this massive peak. It was called Pancake Hill, and it definitely was not flat as a pancake. It was the complete opposite of a pancake. But I got to the top of the hill and we just got this little glimmer of 4G, and a text came through to say that Brian had just left hospital. And I remember that being probably the most adrenaline I've ever felt in my whole life. I had just climbed for like an hour and it's like pumping sweat. It was windy, it was hot. I was just like top of this hill in the middle of nowhere in Utah, and just to get the words that, you know, he pulled through and that they were showing him my live videos and stuff like that in hospital. That was a big, that was probably the best part of the whole trip for me. With regards to low points, I think the low point came the next day. So that's kind of how up and down it was. The low point came, I crossed into, like, across the state border into Colorado, and it's literally like you cross a line and the road surface changed, everything changes. Like, it's like going into a different country. And this gradual little pull, like, I think it was like a 1 or 2%, 2.5% incline all the way. And it technically, you know, according to my Garmin, it went on for 41 kilometers on the bike into a headwind, this small incline all the way. And it kept going and going and going as far. I couldn't see like the end of it. And it just kept going and going. And I remember that being probably the most challenging part of the whole thing mentally. Cause I remember like 8K in being like, I've never done an incline this long that keeps going on. And it went on like another 8 times again. And I was like, this is killing me mentally, you know. But I came up with this thing on that day that I got to the peak of this little annoying hill, and I said to myself, I remember stopping just to go to the toilet or something. I said to myself, I didn't say it to any of the crew, and I didn't really say it to them until afterwards. I said, yesterday you got that amazing news that Brian got out of hospital, it gave you such a lift, you know. I said, it doesn't matter what hills come, what downhills come, what uphills come, what wind comes, et cetera, et cetera. Darkness, daylight, doesn't matter. If you keep moving, America's going to run out of land. And I remember telling myself that, and it was so simple. And I was like, but I remember telling myself, Shane, if you stop, America stops. You're not going to get to the Atlantic Ocean if you keep stopping. So I remember, and I was like, right, that's it. I have to keep moving no matter how slow it is, whether it's uphill, downhill. If I keep moving, America will run out of land. And I remember that. I was like, that's it. I've won. That's it. If I just keep this mindset going forward, I'm going to be able to do it. And the next day I got injured with the Achilles, but I was like, oh God. But it was one of these little things I put in place, and kind of after the low point. It's funny how these things pop up after you think you've hit a bit of a low point. But they were the 2 days that stick out in my mind for sure.
Oh, I love that. I'm definitely putting that quote or that line in the description. Yeah. It's so good. Shane, I'm curious as well, and as someone that's done ultra endurance events not quite to that volume or level, I was even hesitant to ask this question because when I'm asked similar versions of it, I'm like, okay, it depends. You mentioned the mental preparation there, and obviously when you're doing these kind of events, you come up with tactics like that, that if I keep moving, America's going to run out of land. Did you do any mental preparation in the lead up? Or was it a case of, you know, I've done the 24 marathons, I've trained, my body's ready, and I'll figure out what I need to figure out on the day? Or did you have any sort of mental preparation in the lead up? I'm just curious because I know different people have different systems, and it takes a ridiculous amount of mental resilience to do what you did. Did you do anything in the lead up to the event to kind of build your mental strength? Or was it a case of just showing up and figuring it out when you got there?
Really good question. A bit of both, to be honest. I think in general, as Irish people, we tend to wing things. So we wing them, we kind of figure out as we go. There was definitely an element of that because, you know, going into a different country, different continent, there were obviously unknowns going to pop up. And I knew that, look, you're going to have to be ready for things to change. Not everything is going to go according to plan. In fact, probably 80% of the stuff won't go the way you want it to go. And just to be open-minded and to accept that mentally, I think was really important. Because we can build up these, and it's the same as life in general. You know, you can make a plan in your head and it just goes completely arseways. And, you know, it's how you react when things like that happen. And I knew I'd have to carry that into my event in America. But the one thing I also came up with, and to be honest, no, I could stand corrected here. Actually, do you know what? I'll find out. I remember somebody saying before, I listened to a YouTube video or something, one of those kind of motivational mashups. And it said, you know, if you just accept that you're going to have to suffer, I think it becomes a lot easier. You know, if you can paint this perfect picture in your head or running through the forest and the mountains in Utah and stuff like that, but it's not going to feel very good. Do you know what I mean? And I think, you know, you can replicate it in training and things like that. And I remember just, you know, spending December, January, February, like I remember training in the dark more than I trained when it was bright because I like training in the morning. And I remember just, you know, I've had a couple of close calls with cars and stuff like that out training. And I knew if I went out early, the roads would be quieter and stuff like that. I remember one morning, particularly in December, the second weekend of December, a Sunday morning, and I had this thing. Again, it might be a bit Irish. I used to run a marathon before Mass on a Sunday morning, and then I got to come back and I go to Mass with my mother. And I remember one morning, the weather was just, it was atrocious. I mean, it was really, really bad. And I got up early and I was like, you know, you could get sick if you get really wet now and cold. And she looked, want a coffee, we'll call it then and stuff like that. And I nearly didn't go out and I nearly just went back to bed. But I said, look, I'll do 10K and I'll do loops because if I do loops, I'll be near the house, et cetera, et cetera. But I was running down the driveway and I was like, what are you going to do in America if it's raining? Or what are you going to do in America if Sunday and it's cold? I remember that morning, instead of running what I planned to do 40K, I did an extra 10K and I ran 50K. Now I missed Mass that morning, obviously, because I was still out running. But I remember coming back up the driveway that day and being like, that's your biggest win. That's the one that's going to stand you, you know? And I think if you just accept that it's going to hurt and it's going to suffer, but you grow and you do become a little bit stronger when you accept that. I think that's one of the things I put in place. Definitely, I was a lot more mature to that kind of stuff before I was, obviously, with the 24 marathons, 24 days. It was, when I look back, I went into that quite naively. But I knew that America was going to hurt. And I knew it was going to take a lot out of me physically, mentally. I mean, the thing was over a month in duration. I mean, you can prepare for an Ironman or a marathon or a 10K. Or it's just a one day or half day event. This thing was going on for over a month. So I knew that the suffering was going to be quite prolonged and that I was going to be drained and mentally I was going to be really tired. But like I said, you know, when you look back and you see Brian getting out of hospital a couple of days after I started and me coming up the thing, like if America keeps moving, America's going to run out of land. And I suppose the other thing as well is that, you know, my cousin Mary, who she lives at Spina Bifida and she's a phenomenal human being, and her family surprised her with flights to New York. And myself and Mary are really, really close, and they were going to be there on the last day. You know, so I knew through every single day in America that Mary was going to be on the Brooklyn Bridge at 3 o'clock on the 3rd of May, you know. And I knew I had to get there to make sure I was there as well, because I didn't want to keep her waiting, you know. So there was a couple of different things, but I think I'm not going to say I went into it knowing I wasn't going to, you know, I'm definitely not going to fail or anything like that. I was actually quite open to the fact that I might not actually be able to do this. But I think when you go in and just give it your best shot and you just keep moving, take the next step. I think what's his name? James Lawrence, the Iron Cowboy. I remember one of the things that stood out to me from his book, which is take the next step to your best ability, no matter what's happening, no matter the whole world is falling apart, just take that next step, take that next pedal stroke, and you'll be surprised at how far you can get.
So true. I had James on the podcast last year, and it's so similar, your mindsets. Like, he says things and you say things, and if ever there was a quote, success leaves clues, I'm like, just listen to the people who have done these amazing things. And there's this mindset, similar mindset and philosophy, and so much of what you say, I resonate, because you're both yourself, James, and people doing these incredible physical feats. Like, you're building, like, it's mindset. On top of the training, you have to build like a bulletproof mindset in order to get these things done. I'm curious, is there anything that you wish you had known beforehand that you know now? Like, having completed it, was there anything that popped up, good, bad, indifferent, funny, mental, wild, or whatever, that you're like, I wish I'd known that before I took this challenge?
Yeah, there was probably about 100 things, to be honest. But no, I mean, look, I think I knew going in, I don't know what it is, Brian, but I'm not sure if you've covered this before, but I always have this thing in my head, no matter what I'm doing, anything like work stuff, anything, endurance things, anything like that, I always have this thing in my head that I'm an underdog. I don't know why. I just put myself in that place, but it kind of keeps me going. When you think about it, I'm just a young lad from West Kerry that's figured out that he enjoys suffering, really. So I think when I took that to America, I was like, look, I mean, it's gonna be long, it's going to be a long month, it's probably not going to be very pleasant. In fact, like I said, about 75-80% of it wasn't very pleasant. But there were days, you know, where you get to the top of this huge canyon in Utah and you're like, fuck, like this is pretty cool, this is what you kind of train for, etc. If I could have changed anything, I think it would have been maybe spending more time in Colorado beforehand. That would have been probably one of the biggest things I changed, rather than going to San Francisco for 3 weeks. That would have been probably the only thing I would have changed beforehand. During, I'm not really sure, to be honest. During, it, that's going to take me a little bit of time to figure that out even. I think during, I mean, it was, you know, there's certain things you can't change. Like the weather, for example, was mad. It was nuts, really, to be honest, the weather. I mean, day three, there was 10 foot of snow each side of the road, and I couldn't see anything. All I just saw was two white walls either side of me, you know. And I thought, yeah, the spring will be lovely. Nah, the spring was brutal, you know. So there were mornings I was starting, it was like -7, -8 degrees, and you're cycling downhill on a bike. You freeze completely, you know. So should I have done it this time of year? Maybe. Maybe the heat would take less out of me than the severe cold. I'm not too sure, you know. But again, that's kind of looking back in hindsight. I would have been a little bit, during the event, I was getting a little bit annoyed that we couldn't get access to really good food. I suppose in New York and Connecticut and California, I mean, you've got a ton of Whole Foods, you've got a lot of Trader Joe's, really, really nice food, like farmers markets, all this kind of stuff. But yeah, things were pretty bleak in some spots if we stopped for food in America. But other than that, to be honest, I wouldn't change it. I think I think everybody asked, would you do it again? I probably would, to be honest. I know now, I remember straight after being like, I'm never doing anything like that ever again. But it does something to you, man, mentally. It does something. It realizes that, you know, once you were here, you know, it's and now that's just where your ceiling was. And now you've gone through that ceiling, and where's the next ceiling, you know? So I hope I never find that ceiling, to be honest. But it's I'm not really sure I'd change too much, to be honest.
Yeah, it's the high end of enjoying the journey and the process of pushing to see where the limitation is, because you when you break through it, you're like, fuck, what else could I do?
That's it. And sorry to cut across you, but I think that's one thing I'd love listeners to your podcast, any podcast, it's just to realize that the ceiling that's currently above you is not the end. It's not concrete. Like, it's not made out of steel. You can push through it and you can find out, like, well, what can I do now? Like, you know, and that doesn't matter. Like, if you're biking and running across America, or if you're trying to do your first 5K, it's the same thing. You know, you cross that line, you're like, all right, well, that was my old limit. And like, what's my new limit? And that's a pretty cool journey to be on, you know, it doesn't matter what stage you're at.
Yeah, it's so relative. And then, Shane, when you got back and obviously crossed the finish line, talk me through how it felt finishing it, you know, getting to the other side, the Brooklyn Bridge finishing, and how long did it take your body to recover afterwards?
Yeah, I remember, this is a funny story now, I remember about 4 days before I finished, I accepted the fact that I was going to do it. I was going to finish it. Okay. Now, the one other thing that did pop up it started about a week before I finished. I gotten so tired that my reaction times to certain things had gotten quite slow. So basically, for example, I think the messages between my brain were just slowed down a small bit. So if there was a bang to my left, for example, and I was cycling, I remember I would hear sound and it would just take that extra split second for me to turn my head, if that makes sense. So that was quite dangerous on the road. So that became a little bit of an issue. And then towards the end, it also became a little bit of an issue. I had lost the feeling in both my baby fingers. And it started to creep into the next finger inside my baby finger on both hands, just from the handlebars of the bike and bikes. That was getting a bit annoying because I was cycling downhill, I was not able to hold my brakes properly and things like that. So all these things started to kind of pop up towards the end. But we were going through Pennsylvania someday, and Pennsylvania is beautiful. It's a really, really nice place. And I remember just climbing up this little hill and stuff like that, and you know, getting up to the top of the hill. And next thing I see the camper van stopped up ahead, and that we had to obviously two Irish flags flying off the camper vans and things like that. And, you know, there was this Jeep behind, like, blacked out window. And I was like, oh no, like, what are the lads after doing now? They're after crashing into someone or something. And your man was from, like, Waterford or somewhere. He'd been out there for like 25 years. This guy saw the two Irish flags. He said he nearly crashed when he saw the two Irish flags. He said he'd never seen an Irish flag in this part of Pennsylvania before. And like, it was my first time, like, getting to stop and actually chat to a human for like 3 or 4 days outside the crew. So that, like, little things like that were really nice. And I knew I was starting to get a little bit closer. But as I got down to New York, then I got a little bit more excited because my family came over to New York, and my cousin obviously and her family came over and things like that. And I remember I got my first blister about 7 kilometers out from the Brooklyn Bridge, and it really annoyed me because what happened on the last day was I cycled from Connecticut to the edge of Manhattan and ran the last kind of 25K. And just between the jigs and the reels, I never changed my socks. So I cycled down in the rain, of course, and then just ran in my cycling socks. And I remember this blister just starting to bubble. I was like, I've covered 4,910 kilometers. And now I get a blister. I was like, this is so annoying. But I was like, look, I said, if I keep moving, America will run out of land. And surely enough, it did on about 10 past 3 on the 3rd of May. I got to run over the Brooklyn Bridge and down onto Brooklyn Bridge Park with my friend Tim and my friend Laura. And it was awesome, man. It was really cool. I mean, by the end, I'd lost about 10 pounds. That was uncontrollable, to be honest. I was very, very tired for a few days. I was obviously ecstatic and very, really happy to see everybody and stuff like that. But the next couple of days and stuff, I stayed on for a few days just to pack up my stuff and things like that. But I was severely, severely fatigued, really, really tired. I mean, even coming home, I just couldn't stop eating or sleeping. Basically, it was very hard, to be honest. And as well, I had this question. I was like, oh, well, it's done. Like, what do you do now? You know, and it's a question I'd ask myself all the time. I always have plans and goals and stuff like that. But it was a question everybody was asking. Oh, so what's next? Or would you do it again? Or what are you going to do now? And I'm just like, Jesus, man, like, leave me alone. You know, I mean, I just literally spent the last 7 months of my life, 6 months preparing and like a month doing this thing, you know, and I literally have not done nothing else but train and do this thing. So I have a lot of things I obviously want to do over the next kind of year or so. Definitely want to go back and spend some more time in Boulder. It's like the you know, you've got, you know, you've got Muscle Beach in the, it's for the bodybuilders. This is like that, but for endurance athletes, like, it's really, really cool place. I'd love to go back there for a little bit again. And just a ton of things I want to work on, I suppose. And as well, when you do something like this as well, Brian, and you fish it, it kind of gives you, it opens up your eyes a little bit more as well. You're like, all right, sure, you know, same thing's happening now again. I mean, like, you know, what can I do now, you know? And it might not be another massive endurance challenge, but it could be something else. It could become something that challenged me maybe mentally. It could be something that challenged me physically in a different sport. It could be something completely different. I'm not really too sure yet, but I'm still very much so in the mindset of, look, it's done. Make sure you recover properly and let's move forward, you know? So, but again, I'm just grateful to have gone through it without any really serious injury. I mean, I'd be quite close to my GP and stuff here in Dingle, you know, went back for tests on my heart and blood testing and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm delighted to say about 3 weeks ago, actually, he came back and he said, look, you're absolutely fine. Everything looks pretty good. He said you might need to take about another month off from really strenuous stuff, but he said other than that, you're looking pretty healthy. So I'm very grateful that obviously I got that news. And yeah, I suppose next step now is to figure out what's next.
Yeah, the famous words. I was hesitant to even ask that because I know anytime, you know, anyone does any challenge, it's like, okay, what's next? It's like, fuck. It's like the last thing on your mind. You're just trying to recover.
Yeah.
How long, just my own personal curiosity, how long before you kind of felt normal again? Just, I know when I got back from the Arctic, it took me about seven to 10 days, because I just couldn't even comprehend when people were speaking to me. It took me about a week for everything to kind of start switching back on as normal. How long was it before you were like, okay, I'm starting to feel like Shane Finn again? Was it, you know, a week, 2 weeks? Was it pretty quickly? What was the kind of time scale on that, just for out of my own curiosity?
It was about 2 weeks, Brian. So 2 weeks before I was mentally kind of clear again, if that makes sense. You know, I felt like I felt like it was in the past, if that makes sense, you know, because when you're doing these things, you're very much so you're living in a bubble. You know what I mean? I had literally no idea outside of my own circle, in my crew and literally my mother, my brother, my sister at home. I had no idea what was going on in the world, you know, and you live in that little world. And I felt like after 2 weeks I had come back, if that makes sense, and I was no longer living in that place. So, you know, I knew what was going on. I was getting back into normal things. I was, you know, getting a bit of into a sleep routine, stuff like that. Three and a half weeks in, actually, I had regained the kind of 8.5-10 pounds I'd lost. You know, so the body was getting back to some way normal. Physically, I only kind of feel literally within the last 2 weeks I'm moving properly again. You know, just the thing, I'm just my range of motion, I obviously lost quite a lot of range of motion doing things like that. So, you know, I'm in the gym now like 4 or 5 mornings a week, doing a lot of strength work, a lot of mobility stuff. I'm back doing a bit of, you know, back out on the bike kind of 5 days a week, back running kind of 4 days a week. So I had to get back doing what I do. And it's funny, and it's not something that people think about. Maybe you can resonate with this a small bit, but like, I was like, I did, I'm 100% hand and heart. I, like, even up until about a month ago, I felt a bit lost afterwards. I was like, God, like, what do we do now? Like, you know, I was like, I literally did nothing for like I said, that half a year, and just trained like nothing else. And, you know, I had to get back into some kind of I figured out, I constantly have to challenge myself, no matter whether it's writing something, whether it's training. I have to constantly challenge myself on a daily basis, or else I don't feel fulfilled. So basically what I've started doing over the last kind of 2 months is I've gone back to training kind of like twice a day, at minimum once a day, up, you know, 5:30 in bed for 10, reading, setting about time every day to do my online stuff, setting about time every day to do some kind of writing on my laptop, et cetera, you know. So I had to get back to that structure. Obviously it's not structure of biking and running across America, but it's still structure, and I still kind of know I have my days planned out and stuff like that. And that's really important to me, because you can kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't be one to pat myself in the back, but you can kind of faff around after these things and be like, oh, it's great, I did it. And a month later, you can still be telling yourself that you're great. And, you know, a month later, nobody really cares. You know what I mean? So it doesn't really, we kind of have to just get up and move on and keep doing what you're doing, you know?
I think that's great advice. I think anyone that sets a goal and hit the goal, particularly if it was one that you broke through a limitation on, and again, it's relative. For some people, it's a 10K. For some people, it's a marathon. For some people, it's a bodybuilding show or a bikini show. But that feeling of lostness when you come back, it's like, okay, what do I do now? Like, that is very, like, I felt that several times. You know, when I got back from the Arctic, I literally had a book deadline to finish my new book. I was like, I need something that focuses my mind or else I'm going to fall into this like dark hole. And I learned that from previous experiences where you come back and you're faffing around for a month and you're like, yeah, you know, it's too easy. It's too easy to fall into that.
Yeah, no, I noticed it's one of the things I noticed actually, Brian. So about, like I said, about 6 weeks afterwards, you know, the buzz had kind of died down and stuff like that. And I was kind of back to being Shane, back to living a normal life, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just, I know it might sound cliched. I'm not just saying it to say it. I was a bit uncomfortable in myself because I was like, you know, you've pushed yourself so hard. You've reached this new limit and now you've stood back. And like, you know, I'm not saying I had to constantly push and be out running the marathon every morning before mass. But like, you know, I had gotten comfortable again in my own view, in my own, like if I looked at myself in the mirror, I was like, you know, you're gone back, like you're not gone back physically or mentally or anything like that, but you're gone back to being comfortable, you know? So I was like, all right, I said, so what challenges me? What makes me feel uncomfortable? And that's, you know, setting a routine, getting up at 5:30, doing a bit of work, having my coffee, going training, and then coming back, working again, you know, setting a structure and setting kind of goal, like mini goals for myself. And I think that's really important. I think it's something I recommend everybody to do, you know? So I suppose in my world, you know, kind of we say helping people to train for a marathon, their first marathon or whatever, they might run Dublin in October and then do absolutely nothing in kind of February. And then they realize like, oh crap, I'm not in shape anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And I need to get back training. And then the first month back training is just rough, you know. And you know, just keep pushing yourself, keep challenging yourself. Now, not like, again, you don't have to keep hammering yourself every single day, but you know, challenge yourself in more ways than one. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think it's really important to keep the sword sharp. You know, it doesn't have to be like ready to fight, but just keep the sword sharp by doing something that kind of keeps you ticking over with whatever goals you want to achieve or you think you want to achieve in the next 6-12 months.
Sure.
Which brings me on to my last question, Shane, and I'm not going to ask what's next because, you know, we touched on it and I'm like, fuck, I've been asked that question a million times when I've gone on podcasts and I'm like, I'm not going to ask him. But I am going to ask, you're doing so many different things now. What are you excited about the most, or what's the thing that you're most excited about right now?
I think one of the things that's really exciting me right now is that I have a lot of options. I know that might sound like, again, an easy answer, but I suppose beforehand, like, again, maybe some people know I kind of ran my own fitness, co-ran my own fitness facility for like 6 years. So obviously I was very connected to that. And then, you know, we kind of closed that chapter. And literally the minute that chapter closed, started getting ready for America. And now I'm just kind of like, I was like, wow, like, it's just kind of, this is kind of cool. Like I've got time to put into what I want to put into. I'm very, not as far as you are, but I'm very, very early stages of kind of planning out a book. And the book isn't about me. The book is about kind of, you know, it's helping people basically open their mind to endurance and to get people into endurance. It doesn't matter if you're trying to run a 5K or 50K. You know, so I'm kind of working on that. Kind of doing more online stuff, which I love, training people one-to-one and things like that. I'm hoping to go back to America for a little while, which I'd love to go back to Boulder for a little bit. And again, just put myself into a different situation over there, whether it's working with people or, you know, just again, it's broadening my mind, educate myself as much as I can. And I think the other thing as well is you know, what you said, what's next? Like, I want to ask him, but look, let's call a spade a spade. I've signed up for another Ironman, which is Ironman Lake Placid next year. I was there last year. I did fairly well. I'd love to go back next year and like give it a good crack. I'd love to, in the kind of next 3 to 4 years, as a qualifier for the World Championships out in Kona in Hawaii. That's a kind of a big personal goal of mine. I'd just love to go there once and just be in a position, you know, be in a position to bring my family with me. That's a big huge goal of mine, really, to be honest. I mean, my family have never been really kind of to anywhere, I would say, exotic or anything like that. So I'd love to be in a position where I can work really hard, do well, reap the rewards of it, and then, you know, push myself in my endurance stuff and then celebrate collectively by bringing my family on a holiday to Hawaii. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Amazing. Like, Shane, you're a testament to hard work paying off. And I look forward to reading that book when you do have it ready, because that's going to be an awesome read. Shane, I can't thank you enough, one, for your time, and two, for just the inspiration that you give. For anyone that's not following Shane's stuff, I highly recommend go follow his Instagram, go follow any of his channels, his podcast. I'll link it in the show notes. Like, the high end of somebody living
being inspiration by just living their life. Like, I love looking at your stuff. It inspires the fuck out of me when I see you doing these crazy things. So a massive thank you for that. Shane, can you tell everybody listening where's the best place for them to reach out for you for, say, coaching, or where to follow you online, or where you spend your most time in the digital world?
Yeah, so most of my stuff, Brian, kind of similar to yourself, the normal, the main channels online, Instagram at underscore Shane Finn. Facebook page is Shane Finn, and the website, you probably could guess that one as well, is shanefinn.com. So they're my three main things, really. I've had to just channel my energy into those, because I think you can be on loads of different platforms and stuff, but I seem to, you know, my particular audience seem to be on Facebook and Instagram, so that's where I spend the majority of my time.
And for everybody listening, I will link that in the show notes on briankeenfitness.com. So everything that Shane just mentioned. And Shane, thank you so much again, mate. This was awesome, and well done on everything that you've achieved.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on as well.
There you go. Man, that's just badass. Like, fucking hell. Like, yeah, there we go. I've got legs and I've got a bike. I'm going to run and cycle across the USA. Man, absolutely love it. If you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, be sure to tag it on your Instagram stories, tag myself, tag Shane, and be sure to let us know what you thought. And I'll catch you all next week.